Okay, we're running.
All right.
Well, we're interviewing former Representative Carl O'Neill. Carl served in the Montana House of Representatives in the 1949 session, and we're interviewing him at his home here in Columbia Falls. Carl, what was the legislature like? What are your impressions of what the legislature was like as you entered it in 1949? Maybe I should ask you, what motivated you to run, and how old were you?
I was 29 years old. I had just finished getting my master's degree at the university, and my topic for my thesis had been budget making and expenditure control in the state system of Montana. And so I was really interested in following up on that. And while I had been researching for that, I'd spent time at the Capitol, and I guess I was kind of struck with the aura of power there. I thought, ooh, it would be fun to be in this House of Representatives. And see a picture up there.
Yes, you bet. That's the picture that hangs on the in the front of the House chamber,
yeah,
painted by Charles Russell on
correct
your wall here in your
yeah
living room.
And so I, without talking to any politicians or anything, I just put my name in as a candidate. And the local Democrats were shocked. Well, who is this? You know, and I was, as I say, I was 29 and I looked young. And so my first impression then of the legislature, I guess, was what a friendly, sociable place it was. I had no idea what to expect in that regard. Most everybody there was older than I. They were established figures. There was one young man there who was 24 from Miles City. His name was Keith Trout, I think, and he was he represented a labor viewpoint. So he was younger than I. But and another thing that struck me was how many social things they did. Almost every day there was some group there to entertain. a school group or something like that.
A school choral group that would maybe come in and sing before the House of Representatives,
yes,
or
yes,
something?
Uh-huh. And then another impression was that, oh, most of the power people stayed at the Placer Hotel. And so the lobby of the Placer Hotel at night was a kind of very informal forum. And you'd kind of drift around through here and you'd see Gurney Moss from Whitefish talking with somebody, Senator Gurney
yes
Moss.
Yes, oh yeah. And I met him when I was just a young man. I first entered politics, as I know you know, in the election of 1970. And Gurney lived, I think, until the early 1970s. He had been the editor and publisher of the Whitefish Pilot.
Yes.
And I visited with him, had one lengthy visit with him one day, and very much enjoyed it. He was kind of an intellectual gentleman from Missouri, I think. He was also, when you were a legislator, a pretty influential legislator, wasn't
he? Yes,
he
was. And he didn't take me under his wing, but he was kind to me. And I felt no partisanship between us. You know. And at any rate, he and people of his generation spent a lot of time together in the Placer Hotel lobby at night talking.
It was a kind of a melting pot, an exchanging place for ideas and that sort of thing?
Yeah, just especially legislators talking about, they'd talk about bills, you know, what sort of thing. One thing I want to tell you, this may be a bit shocking, but one thing that really struck me was that up the gulch a ways from the Placer Hotel, there was a brothel. I don't remember the name of it. It was somebody's rooms. And I learned that quite a few legislators hung out there, and that was a kind of discussion place where they... I never went there. I was too
the
young.
Dorothy's rooms, perhaps?
I think it was Dorothy's rooms.
Yeah, yeah.
And I never had nerve enough to go there, but... And besides, I didn't want to go there, but I was always struck. I wonder what those guys do there all evening, you know. So, there are some initial thoughts. Then I was impressed, too, with how seriously the leaders took the business. Leo Graybill, I was a Democrat. Leo Graybill was the head of the party. And
he was the Speaker of the House?
He was the Speaker of the House. And he was very serious about the work and how he made committee appointments and how he involved people in the issues at hand, how he attempted to influence their votes.
Did Leo Graybill, the Speaker of the House, you say did you have caucuses in which you discussed issues?
Yes, we had occasional caucuses. Initially we had a caucus or two to discuss committee assignments, and then we had occasional caucuses, but not very often. He would come to you individually.
Oh, he came to you individually.
Yeah.
I see. So you had an opportunity occasionally to visit with the Speaker, and he was interested in making sure you were on board on important issues, I mean, that you would vote.
He would.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't put a lot of pressure on you. I remember one bill which would authorize school districts, I think it was, to bus children to Catholic schools on public buses. The school bus that went to Flathead County High School could also take children to St. Matthew's School.
Sure.
And I thought I didn't see anything wrong with that. But Leo came to me and he said, "Now, you know, this gets into an issue of church and state. You can vote any way you want to, but I just want you to know that this can lead to an issue of church and state." And so I still voted to allow the bill, but I felt the mm-hmm. leadership of Leo Graybill there.
I see.
There wasn't extreme pressure. It was just, I don't think about that, Carl. So.
Did the Flathead County legislators work together as a group?
No, we didn't really. There were three of us. There was Ori Armstrong, who was a Republican.
And he later became Speaker of the House of Representatives, didn't he, I believe, in the 50s?
Know.
Yeah, I think he did.
Yeah. And then there was Ernest Burns from
Whitefish. Who was a railroad employee, I think.
He was a railroad employee.
Yeah. Just briefly tell us about those two.
Well, Ernest Burns and I sat next to each other in the legislature because we were both Democrats. And I never knew just where Ernest Burns was coming from. He was always friendly, but I never felt that we really related. I think he didn't trust me because I came from a
business background.
Mm-hmm. And I never felt that he really trusted me. We never conferred much on legislation. I don't recall ever discussing a piece of legislation with him.
I see.
I always felt that he had his opinion that was formulated someplace else than my presence. With Ori Armstrong, I felt friendlier with him, really, than with Ernie. And Ori told me once that after the session, people asked him, "Well, how did Carl O'Neill do over there?" And he said, "Oh, he did fine. He's a little young, but he did fine."
Carl, how was it that you happened to run as a Democrat? Because I know your family, and I guess your nephew Jerry serves in the state Senate now as a Republican. But my guess would have been that for the most part, the O'Neills are Republicans.
Very much so.
How did it happen that you ran as a Democrat?
Well, I was young. I was idealistic. I had majored in history and political science in undergraduate school. And I just had a more liberal view, I guess. It wasn't rebellion against my father. I just felt that, and also at that time, the Democrats were for low tariffs. I believed in that. And also, I didn't think it would do any harm to run as a Democrat because I'd probably pick up some Republican votes.
I see. Well, that's probably a shrewd way of looking at it, too. So you've mentioned Leo Graybill, who was a prominent attorney from Great Falls, and whose son, I believe, served as the chair of the Constitutional Convention in 1972.
Oh.
And so that family's been active in politics for some time. And I believe that Leo Grebel, that you served with, but it could have been his son, also ran for Congress from Montana. So they've had an impact in the politics of our state. And he stands out in your mind from what you said as, a, as an important legislator. Were there other important legislators? Were there other colorful legislators? Were there other individuals in the legislature, in the House or Senate, that made a particular impression on you?
Well, Leo Grebel really stands at the top for me. I saw him as a thoughtful politician, definitely a politician, but also I would qualify him as a statesman. I think he would put state above party where that made sense. So I thought a lot of him. Others, I think the, who was his name, Lobel?
Probably Lester Lobel. Was a, there were Lobels in the legislature from Lewis and Clark County, from Helena?
Yes. I think he was,
they were attorneys, I think?
Yeah, he was an attorney, and he was, he had some leadership role. And I was quite impressed with him. I thought he handled him very, himself very well. Other than that, my best friend in, turned out in the legislature to be an arch-conservative from Scobey, Montana. His name was Neil Taylor.
Neil Taylor.
Uh-huh. He was not a statesman. He was, he wasn't even, well, he was sort of a politician, but he wasn't out to make a big name for himself. He was just there doing his job, sort of. But we ended up on a subcommittee together, and we had to travel around together. And we just developed a great relationship, which continued after that session was over. I liked him.
I think his son was a professor of mine at Montana State in Bozeman.
Why didn't I know he had a son?
Well, maybe it could have even been a nephew. He was from up in the Scobey country, and his name was Taylor, and I vaguely remember he might even have been related to Red Flag Taylor, the communist back in the 30s.
Oh, really?
You say this fellow was a conservative, but there was a lot of division up in that part of the state.
Oh, I see.
My guess is that, that my professor's father or uncle was probably Neil Taylor.
Oh, really?
My guess would be that would be the case. Well, that's interesting. Now, you know, we hear a lot about the great influence of the Anaconda Company.
Yeah.
During the period in which you served in the legislature. Do you have any thoughts or observations on that?
Well, the first thought that comes to my mind is that there were several representatives from Butte who sat in the row right in front of me. There were, I forget how many there were. There was one woman. And then there was a young attorney who was there. And I don't think the Anaconda Company was as prominent, perhaps, as it had been, or perhaps would be. But this young attorney and I were once talking about the influence of the Anaconda Company. And he said, well, I'm an attorney. I work for the Anaconda Company. And he said, they don't tell me what to do. I vote the way my conscience tells me to, but I happen to believe the same way that the Anaconda Company does. So I thought that was interesting. And I think as an employee of the Anaconda Company, well, of course he would vote
sure
the way they wanted to. There was an interesting woman there from Butte, too, and she owned a bar. And she was a lot of fun. And of course, she represented the interest of bar owners, and in those days, then slot machines was a big issue, and of course she was gung-ho for slot machines, and in a very charming way she presented this stuff, and that was fun. The Anaconda, I mean, yeah, the Butte group seemed to be rather close-knit. They had a little kind of fraternity there, and they talked easily back and forth. I never knew exactly how much the Anaconda Company had their finger on, but I never felt, I don't think an Anaconda lobbyist ever approached me directly. They had a lobbyist there. I knew he was a lobbyist. He was a young man. He may even have been an attorney, and he was an artist. And he drew, he would draw a legislator aside and draw a portrait, pencil sketch portrait, which was a kind of an end for him. And, and it was a nice gift and so on. I remember at the end of the session, I went by him one day, and he was sitting there sketching something. I said, "Oh, I wish I was a Republican and an Anaconda advocate so I'd get my portrait done." And a couple days later, he came to me and said, "I'll do your portrait."
You still have that?
I have it someplace. But yeah, it wasn't anything I framed. But
sure.
And he not only did a portrait, but he did a, what do you call it, caricature.
Do you remember who that was?
Oh, I never, I
have
no
know
idea.
At the time, yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I just have no idea.
You mentioned the gambling issue. Now, it runs in my mind that there was a Supreme Court decision of some kind or other that made it possible for maybe it was even a law of the legislature, for fraternal organizations, nonprofit organizations, to have legalized gambling. And so many taverns would declare a part of their building a benign order of something or other, and that's where they'd put their slot machines in.
Yeah.
And so this existed in Montana. Slot machines existed in Montana that way, if my memory serves, for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years until maybe the legislature repealed the law or the Supreme Court acted in a different way or something. Do you remember anything about that?
Well, now that you mention it, I had forgotten it, but I do recall that there was something like that. Like the bowling alley had a Kegler's Club.
Yeah.
And the Elks Lodge had slot machines.
Yes. Yeah.
And then the VFW had slot machines.
Yeah.
I don't remember about the American Legion. But yeah, there were slot machines.
Was that a controversy in the legislature?
Yes, it was. Gambling as such was a controversy. I don't remember about the clubs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I was opposed to gambling. I voted against gambling. And another thing. Can I take
Yeah, please,
that?
Yeah.
Another thing about veterans, an issue that came up was cash bonus for Montana citizens who've been in World War II. And it was quite a powerful issue because, of course, the veterans groups supported this, or at least there were what I call professional veterans who supported this. And I didn't make any speeches in the House of Representatives, but I did make a speech against a cash bonus for veterans. And I remember I started out by saying, "I'm one of these heroes of World War II that you seek to honor with a veterans bonus, but I'm voting against it. And my reason for voting against it is that while we were overseas doing what we had to do, what in a way we were privileged to do. Our parents were home, our families were home, they were living on rations and they were paying their taxes and they were worrying night after night about what was happening to us. And I said, I don't see wisdom in taxing them now to give us a cash bonus. Do everything possible for veterans who need it, who suffered, who were injured. Take care of them by all means, but do not vote a bonus. And after that, Corey Armstrong congratulated me on that. I think he took that position too, and he was a veteran,
mm-hmm.
a supporter of veterans.
Mm-hmm.
I always felt that was right.
Well, that was certainly a courageous decision.
Well,
my guess is the bill passed.
Oh, of course
it
passed.
Yeah.
And some, when I got home, some veterans were rather rude to me.
Oh.
And I understood that. But,
you know, Carl, too, during that session, it runs in my mind that the what we came to call for many years the School Foundation Program was first legislated into effect, and I believe that happened, I think, in the 1949 legislature. And Gurney Moss, who we mentioned earlier in our conversation, was characterized by some, at least around here, as the father of the School Foundation Program. It may have had several fathers.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember anything about that? The idea that there needed to be some coordinated method for funding the public schools at the state level that tried to bring some kind of coherence and equality to school funding?
No, I'm sorry, I don't remember it in much detail. I do remember that at that time there was considerable controversy about whether the federal government should subsidize education in the states. And one time, while we were running for the legislature, Gurney Moss and I debated that in Whitefish in the high school auditorium one evening. There was quite a crowd there. And his position was that federal money should not be accepted for state education. And my position was that it should be. But
And his position was based on the idea that he didn't want the federal government to have a controlling influence, and he felt the control would go with the money?
Yes.
And your position was?
I didn't think it would be that bad.
And you felt that the benefit would be greater than the downside?
Correct, yes.
What committee did you serve on?
The most important committee I served on was appropriations.
Because of your background, is it?
Yes.
Your graduate degree was what, in economics?
No, history and political science.
Your undergraduate was, and then your master's degree was in?
Same
thing,
yeah.
I see.
And when they were making committee assignments, Leo Bagel asked me, what would you like? And I said, I'd especially like to be on the Appropriations Committee because of this.
Yeah.
And he said, well, he said, I don't think I can make you chairman. And I said, well, I don't expect that. No, but he did appoint me. And then I was on the subcommittee of the Appropriations Committee that dealt with state institutions.
Oh, okay.
And by a fluke, I think there were four of us, and by a fluke, the other Democrat on the committee wasn't able to serve, and I became chairman of this subcommittee of institutions. And it was no big deal, but it was kind of fun. And the other, I got along well with the two Republicans, one of whom was this Neil Taylor from Scotland. And we went out and visited some of the institutions. And it really had an effect on my life, what I saw out there. So that was a very interesting assignment. Grateful that Leo Bagel for
Did you then go and visit the institutions?
Yes. We went to the Orphans Home at Twin Bridges, which no longer exists. Mm-hmm. We went to Boulder.
Any memories of those visits stand out in your mind?
Yes. And we went to Warm Springs. And I suppose that's the most vivid memory.
Warm Springs was and is the state mental institution.
Correct. And at that time, it was a huge place and very overcrowded. I was just shocked when we walked into some of these huge day rooms, they called them, where people just sat, and just some of them in their own filth. And I just, oh my, I hadn't really been aware of mental health before then. And I was really concerned about that. And then the next place would be the Orphans Home in Twin Bridges. There again, I was awed by what I saw, all these children in the care of the state. And I said to myself, someday I think I'll get into this kind of business. I want to do some kind of service of that. The administrator with whom I was most impressed was at Boulder, which was the home for, they call them mentally retarded, I think, feeble-minded, I think they call them. Mm-hmm. And that administrator was a doctor, a medical doctor. And I just, they had lunch for us. And I just was impressed with what I saw as his commitment to the care of these people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his salary was something like $10,000
sure.
a year.
Yeah.
And so those are my impressions there.
Do you remember his name?
I'm sorry, I don't.
I mentioned to you too earlier that you served during the administration of Governor John Bonner.
I did.
And there were other statewide elected officials, I believe, during that period of time. Austin Middleton, I believe, was a public service commissioner. Arnold Olson was attorney general, if I remember correctly, at that time. Do you have any recollections or impressions of any of those gentlemen? We'll start with Governor Bonner.
Well, Governor Bonner, he was a he was friendly, outwardly friendly, He always seemed busy and detached. He was pretty friendly, but he was rushing off. And he really let the party down. He really let the state down. He got in trouble down south someplace.
What's your recollection of that? Because I remember something about some kind of an incident at the governor's conference or something or other.
Yeah.
How do you remember this incident?
Well, I only know of it through the newspapers, of course, but he was arrested in a brothel someplace down there, and I think he was drunk and tried to resist arrest or something like that.
Well, he was attending the governor's conference, the national governor's conference, and it was down in New Orleans or
someplace
Mobile, Alabama or something.
Yeah, I think it was Alabama. And I was really disappointed about that. I thought it kind of showed the level of his commitment, his principles.
Now, this incident occurred after the legislative session in which you served. Did it surprise you, I mean, knowing the governor as you did?
Yeah, it surprised me.
You wouldn't have imagined that he would have engaged in any kind of activities like that.
I wouldn't have. No, I wouldn't have imagined it. After I heard about it, I thought, oh, okay, I guess that's him, you know. But
did you ever visit with him, meet with him personally when he was governor?
No, never.
Just had an impression of him in the hallway, maybe, or behind the podium?
Yeah. He had a very attractive secretary. Had a relationship. We did a lot of things together, like go dancing at the Montana Club and that sort of thing. So, but I don't think she ever spoke to the governor about me. Another public figure at the state level, though, that I did have more of a relationship was Mary Conlin. She was superintendent of public instruction. She was an Irish gal with a great wit, and she was just a natural politician. She could come up with answers and justifications for positions that I just used to fascinate me. She was a very sharp gal, and I always felt it was too bad that she left the state after her term was up.
Well, she was defeated by Harriet Miller in a kind of an upset election, I think in 1952, perhaps in the Eisenhower landslide. And she ended up going back to Washington, D.C., and I think she worked for Senator Metcalf for a while, but perhaps maybe she went back there when he was a member of the House of Representatives. I'm not sure, but she was back there for many years.
Yeah.
And her married name was Giroux, and Mary Condon Giroux was a fairly influential figure in the mix of things back in Washington, D.C. for a number of years. I don't know if she's still living or not.
Well, we lived in Alexandria, Virginia for 4 years, 1983 to 1987. And one day I had a reason to call Senator Melcher.
I think that is right. I think maybe she left Metcalf and went to Melcher.
Yeah.
I think that is right.
And I said, my name is Carl O'Neill. I'd like to talk to somebody about something. And the person on the phone said, Carl O'Neill. And I heard somebody in the background say, Carl O'Neill? I want to talk to him. It was Mary Condon.
And she remembered.
Yeah, she remembered. And so it turned out that she lived with her husband. I think he was Sergeant of Arms in the Senate.
That could be.
They lived in an apartment house right across the street from us in Alexandria.
Gosh, right across the street?
Yes.
Literally.
Yeah, literally. And so Mary and I had lunch together and talked over old times. She was still just as sharp on this stuff as she'd ever been.
Yeah. I've heard good things about her. Now, Arnold Olson was the young attorney general then, I think, too. Any recollections of him? He, of course, later went on and served 10 years in Congress.
Yeah. Oh, I have. My recollections of him are more negative than positive. He didn't relate to me at all. He just looked past me. which is okay, except, you know, you're sensitive to that sort of thing. And I never quite trusted them. They're the same party.
Is there a basis for that? Just a intuition?
No, intuition. Yeah.
When you first ran for the legislature, are there any incidents or stories that stand out in your mind in terms of your campaign? Here you're this young 29-year-old, you're starting out in politics, running for public office for the first time. Some folks may think, gee, we would have assumed Carl from his family background would be a Republican. Did you do a lot of public speaking? Did you go door to door? Did you debate your opponents?
I didn't debate my opponents, and I didn't go door to door. I was asked to speak to various groups. I remember speaking to business and professional women in Columbia and Kalispell, and then I had that debate with Gurney Lawson I spoke of with Whitefish. There was a man in Kalispell by the name of Tom.
What did he do?
He ran the flathead commercial company.
McLeod?
No. Elliott. Tom Elliott.
Okay.
Tom Elliott was a well-to-do businessman in Kalispell. He was well thought of. He had been my Sunday school superintendent and my Sunday school class teacher. He was a fine man. He was a Democrat, which was unusual for a businessman in Kalispell. And he just seemed delighted that I was running, and he spoke on the radio for me, and spoke at various groups for me. I was so touched by this.
Oh yes, yeah.
And just a fine man. I don't know how I got over that.
Well, that's interesting. That was a memory that stands out from when you campaigned for public office.
Yes. Yeah, he kind of, he didn't take me under his wing exactly. He just was a supporter.
Now, it runs in my mind too, but I may have the election year mixed up, but wasn't there that might have occurred earlier. I was thinking there was a real tough Democratic primary between Leif Erickson and Burton K. Wheeler, but I think that was in 1946.
Yeah, I don't think that was this year.
Yeah, that wasn't in the year that you ran in 1946.
Yeah, and Leif Erickson, somehow he used to drop in and say hello once in a while. I had warm feelings for him. I'd see him at the legislature.
Yeah.
And then later I was working for my dad in Kalispell, and Leif stopped in several times just to say hello.
Very friendly.
Very friendly. Yeah. Now his son Bart, I guess, lives at Whitefish.
Actually Bart's now down in Missoula, and he's a federal magistrate.
Yeah.
He's a federal judge.
Uh-huh.
But he was the district judge in Flathead County I think briefly.
Uh-huh.
He practiced law, as you know, for many years in Whitefish.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, there was a big schism in the Democratic Party in Montana that resulted from his challenge of Burton K. Wheeler, who had been a U.S. senator for a long time.
Yeah.
I think that happened in 1946.
Yeah.
So did you run for re-election in 1950?
I did. I have to say my heart was not in it. I don't think I've ever said that to anybody before. But my legislative experience had been interesting. And I felt that I'd served honorably. I voted my conscience. I sponsored some worthwhile things. But I found it, I didn't like some things where there was controversy, even acrimony. And so I thought, if I'm not re-elected, it's okay. And it turned out that it was a Republican sweep.
In 1950.
Yes. There were some good people running in Kalispell. Cal Robinson ran for county attorney. He was defeated. Gordon Romney ran for state senator. He was defeated. All Democrats were defeated except Dick Walsh. He was re-elected as
county sheriff.
Yeah. So, there's three spots.
Do you remember who the three Republicans who replaced you and Ernest Burns in the House of Representatives were? Would that have been about the time of maybe Cliff Haynes?
I don't know.
Clifford Haynes or
possibly.
Or maybe Bob Sykes?
That's a possibility. I think Ori Armstrong.
Ori would have been reelected.
Yeah.
Of course, yeah.
But I don't remember the other two. I've blown it. It was a nasty campaign.
Oh, it was.
Oh, it was terrible.
Was your record attacked?
Oh, yes. And, oh, yes, this is, in my mind, this is important. One day in the House, somebody came to me, I have no idea now who it was, and said, here's a letter that you want to send to Congress. And it, what it said, in effect, was that the rain that falls in the mountains belongs to the people. And so the use of the rain for the generation of power should be for the welfare of the people. This, I signed this thing. I thought, sure, I believe in that. The rain that falls in the mountain belongs to the people, and they should profit from its use. And this was not a formal memorial. It never appeared before the House. It was just a group of people, like-minded people, who sent this thing off to Congress. That was all I ever heard about it. And then one day, after the session, and just before the next election, I was working for my dad in the lumberyard in Kalispell, and I got a phone call from the assistant editor of the Interlake, who accusingly said to me, you once signed a letter to the United States Congress saying that the rain in the mountains belonged to all the people, didn't you? Well, it took me by great surprise, and I don't know how I responded.
You must have remembered it, though.
Oh, I surely did, yeah. And his attitude was just, I've got you nailed, you know. And it really took me by surprise, really. And so then his editor, a man by the name of Victor Morgan, who had been sent in here as editor for a time from some other place, really ran with this thing. And they had a front page editorial, as I remember, which said, in effect, that if I were reelected, Flathead Lake would be raised and Kalispell could be flooded. And it was way out. and of course, I had a good response to that. I said, I have an island in Flathead Lake that my father gave me for Christmas one year. You think I'm going to let him submerge that island? And this Victor Morgan was really aggressive. And there was a man in Kalispell. His name was Frohlicher, Steve Frohlicher. Did you know him?
I don't think so.
He was a reporter for the Missoula.
I see.
And of course, he hated the Interlake, and he hated this Victor Morgan. And he came to me, and he said, I looked it up down at the courthouse, and he said, Victor Morgan is not even registered to vote in this county.
Huh.
So of course, I used that.
Uh-huh, sure.
Oh, it was awful. But, and then the night before the election, the Interlake got out a special edition and delivered it door to door just before midnight, all throughout the town, maybe throughout Whitefish too, I don't know. And that was, it was a powerful thing against Democrats. And that was nasty.
Mm.
And that kind of nastiness was one of the things that I didn't miss about going back.
Why was the Interlake so partisanly involved?
Well, here's what I think happened. You asked about legislators, about lobbyists. I think that Montana Power was alert to that letter and that sort of feeling and so on. And I think that they saw that, and so then they moved in a lobbyist way, kind of behind the scenes. And of course, Victor Morgan was Republican, and he was responsive to this pressure, if that's what it was, mm-hmm. from Montana Power, stop this young guy. He's a radical. And there was a lobbyist for the Montana Retail Lumberman Dealers Association, whom I knew because I was working in retail lumber. And somebody told me that some other lumberman who knew my father asked this lobbyist, how did that young Carl O'Neill do there? And the lobbyist said, oh, he's a radical. I was deeply hurt by that. Mm-hmm. I was not a radical. I really was. I don't think I was a radical. I mean, remember, at this in this era, communism was highly suspect. Yeah.
So the idea that all the water belongs to all the people sounded like a kind of a left-wing concept.
Yeah. It could be that you didn't like Montana Power.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't really like some of the things Montana Power. I didn't like their grasp on things. But I did, nobody bothered to ask me, but I did think that the water that fell in the mountains could probably be best developed and marketed privately.
Yeah.
But still, the people should be the winners on,
mm-hmm.
On its value.
Mm-hmm.
So that was dirty, I thought.
Did you see an association between the Montana Power Company and the Anaconda Company?
Well, I always assumed there was, but I didn't see any. I wasn't aware of any direct.
Uh-huh. I think for a while, at least, they had the same board of directors, and the Montana Power Company was created by the Anaconda Company a century or more ago to produce the electrical power necessary for the Anaconda Company.
I see.
So there was certainly a relationship, and that probably would still have existed pretty strongly in the 1940s and 50s when we were involved.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure. But no lobbyists from Montana Power or Anaconda Company ever approached me directly. As a matter of fact, I don't remember any lobbyist ever approaching me, except this guy from the Lumber Dealers Association.
Who was that?
I don't know his name.
Was he from around here?
He lived in Helena.
I see. Do you remember the organized labor, the FFL-CIO, any significance in regard to them?
I don't. The only thing I remember about them is Ernie Burns.
Yeah.
And then this Keith Trout, who came from
Miles City. How about the Farmers Union?
I felt some I felt their presence in the campaign preceding the election. They invited me to speak to them once. I remember going to a meeting down on the west side of Kalispell and speaking with them. They were known as radical, and I was a little uncomfortable at the meeting because I'd heard some were communists, and I didn't know how to talk to communists.
Mm.
And of course, I wanted to make a good impression on them, but I didn't know how to do it.
Sure.
My impression there is that Farmers Union was suspect by more conservative people. It was suspect as communistic.
This would have been kind of at the beginning of the Red Scare era, maybe not even at the beginning of it, I don't know. The so-called McCarthy era,
yeah.
Extended from, what, the late 40s into the middle 50s, or late 50s even?
I don't remember just when it began. But I do know there was a lot of feeling about communism and socialism at this time.
And that was apparently it was, as a political issue. I mean, if you could tar someone as questionably a socialist or a communist, you could really damage them politically.
Oh, yeah. And that's kind of the implication of the Interlake made in there. And I but they let it flow with Cal Robinson and Gordon Arnold.
Yeah. remember any folks named Sidereus involved in the Farmers Union?
Yeah, I did.
Because they continued to be involved in politics here. In fact, George Sidereus was elected to the House of Representatives in 1954.
I remember that.
And I served in the House of Representatives in Montana when he was in the state Senate. And got to know him. So, any recollections of him?
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is I knew where they lived down south of Kalispell. I knew their farm. And they went to Presbyterian Church. I knew them vaguely there. And then one day I had a phone call from him. I was still unmarried. I was living with my parents. He said, I'd like to come and talk to you. So he came. And I saw him at my parents' home in Kalispell. And he said, I'm thinking of running for the legislature. What would you think of that? And what advice would you give me? And so I don't know beyond that, but we chatted, and I guess I probably encouraged him to run. Yeah. And I think he ran successfully.
Yeah, he did. He was in the House from 54 to 58, and then in the Senate from about 58 to about 74. He was there for quite a while.
Yeah, so he must have been well thought of.
Yeah, I think he was. Yeah, I think he was. Do you remember the other legislators that I visited with in several cases have made mention of the watering holes, as they were called. They were hospitality rooms.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the lobby of the Placer as a kind of a big melting pot and meeting place and that sort of thing. But as I understand it, the railroads, maybe as an association, I know the Anaconda Company, and I'm not sure who else, but there might have been at some time or other several of these hospitality rooms existed, and legislators could go there and have, roast beef sandwiches and whiskey and beer and that sort of thing. And do you remember anything about those?
I was vaguely aware that they existed, but I was never invited to one. But the one I remember was not a hospitality room. It was the Montana Club.
Yes.
I loved that place.
Yes.
It had class.
Yes.
But you went there at your own expenses.
Sure.
And I do recall being invited to a dinner sponsored by somebody. I don't know now who it was. I attended a dinner.
Uh-huh.
But so far as hospitality rooms, no, I never went to one.
Do you remember an old fellow who was the bartender at the Montana Club by the name of Julian Anderson?
No.
I guess he was an African-American descent.
Oh, really?
And he was the bartender there for some incredible amount of time.
Oh.
Like from 1914 to 1974 or something like that. I don't know. Maybe it must have been 64, because I think I would have remembered him in 74. But was a legendary bartender.
Oh,
anyway.
Well. Huh. No, I remember some good times there. This Val Ordell, who was the governor's secretary, we went there and danced and had a few drinks and that sort of thing. But, it was a great place.
There was a young fella in my memory here by the name of Blake Wardell, who probably was related in some way or other to Val, who I think served maybe at the cabinet level in the Governor Judge's administration.
Okay.
He might also have been a county commissioner in Lewis and Clark County briefly, too.
Okay.
Right? But that's from Helena area, so there could be that connection.
Could be. I didn't know she had a brother, but that doesn't mean anything.
Well, he would have been maybe a fair amount younger.
I see.
Yeah, he might have been, I'm thinking he would probably be in his 50s now. I've lost track of him. But there could be a connection there. You remember about any other specific piece of legislation in the 1949 session? We talked a little bit about gambling. We talked a little bit about education. You mentioned you sponsored some bills.
Well, I sponsored one bill, or I was asked to introduce one bill. Gordon Ronlund asked me.
Gordon Ronlund was a prominent attorney in Kalispell for many years.
A prominent attorney, a Democrat.
And a Democrat.
Yeah. And I don't know who drafted this bill. It was probably the Park Service, National Park Service. But at any rate, the bill enabled the trade of some state land at the border of Glacier National Park for some federal land. And so I did introduce that bill. And I think I may have got Lori Armstrong to co-sign on that. I've kind of forgotten about that. But at any rate, the bill passed with no problem. It was really not controversial. It just enabled this transfer. It increased the size of Glacier Park and didn't harm the state any. And so that was a bill that I...
So it expanded the size of Glacier Park on the west side of the park?
I think so.
That's why you introduced the bill,
yeah.
Because it was on the Flathead County side of the park.
Mm-hmm.
So where would the area have been along the North Fork of the Flathead River? Is that where it would have been? Or it would have been south of Highway 2, maybe?
No, I think it would have been
the Essex
north
area.
I think it would have been... I never went to see it, really. But I think it would have been sort of... probably west and north of Belt or West Glacier, in that area someplace.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that's... Yeah.
And it was quite a few acres. It was over... In my mind, it was like 1,200 acres. I'm not sure.
Yes,
about
yeah.
Yeah.
And Governor Bonner signed it into law.
Yeah. Yeah. And, and then the summer then, Red Ranger took me fishing one day up at Kintla Lake to thank me for my sponsorship of the bill. But when they had the dedication, they didn't invite me to that. They had Oral Armstrong go and speak, which was okay. But those are funny details, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. Anything else in your experience as a legislator, or any impression maybe about Montana politics during that period of time you'd like to visit about? Kind of an open-ended question.
Yeah, I mentioned the Placer Hotel and the older people, better established people. Stayed at the Placer Hotel.
Now, what do you mean by better established people?
Well, I mean like Gurney Moss.
The more senior legislators.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
Gurney, of course, had served in the House of Representatives clear back in the 20s at the time, I think, of Governor Joe Dixon. And clear through the 30s off and on, he'd been defeated a time or two. And when you served with him, he'd been in the Senate. But I think he'd been the minority leader for the Republicans in the House of Representatives. In the 20s or 30s, a time or two, and he might even have been the Republican floor leader in the Senate at the time you were there, or about the time you were there. But he was a pretty prominent Republican politician from Flathead County and actually in Helena for maybe close to a quarter of a century.
Oh, very, yes. And I respected him. I didn't agree on things, but he was a decent, honorable man. And he was working not for a career, but for the state. I always felt that about him. People like him, who they had an income. They didn't have to live on the $7 per diem that we got when I was there. And so they stayed at the Placer Hotel, which was more expensive. I stayed at the YMCA, where I got a room, I think, for $1 a night. I'm not sure about that. But the YMCA doesn't have rooms anymore there, but they did then. And I don't know. I just had a good feeling really about life in Montana. I felt that there were good people in the legislature who wanted to do the right thing. We might not agree on what the right thing was, but we were striving to do the right thing for a great state that we all cared about. I also was rather surprised at how much fun legislators had. There were all these parties and all these entertainments and so on. That took me by surprise. It was okay. You needed to relax and
So the parties were what, like birthday parties? I've heard that there used to be occasionally birthday parties for legislators and that sort of thing.
Might be, or just like dating, like Val and I dated. And other people were out socially at night. And they had there was a place west of town, kind of an owl, night owl.
Night owl, yeah, probably.
That was a hangout for legislators, too.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm trying to say is there was an element less than serious, and some of it slightly corrupt, like going to Dorothy's rooms, that sort of bothered me, my Presbyterian conscience, and my idealism about what statesmanship involved. But overall comes the stronger feeling that there were people there who cared.
Carl, you mentioned it stood out in your memory, apparently, that you had been to one dinner.
Yeah.
Well, why did that stand out in your memory?
I don't know.
Was that hosted by a corporation or something?
Yeah, it was hosted by some group.
Like the Montana Power Company or the Anaconda Company?
That I can't say. I'm not sure. It was probably, I just don't know.
Like a sit-down dinner around the table in which legislation was discussed and other legislators were there too?
Oh, I don't remember that there was any legislation discussed. It was just
were other legislators present?
Yeah, I remember my friend Neil Taylor was there.
Yeah.
But that's the only hosted thing I ever...
That would be as close as you can remember that you ever lobbied.
Right.
Yeah, I see. Now, you mentioned that Gertie Moss stayed at the Placer Hotel. Did Ori Armstrong stay there?
I'm sure he did.
And so do you think that was a place where more Republicans than Democrats stayed?
That I don't know.
Do you know any other people who stayed there? I mean, did you visit them there, have dinner with them there, anything like that?
I don't recall ever having dinner there. It was an evening hangout, and you might just drift in or drift down from your room if you lived there.
Sure.
And talk. And there was one other young legislator there. He was a Democrat, and he was very serious, very devoted to his work. John, I've never seen him since then, and I've always respected and admired him and wondered what happened to him. But he and I used to...
What county was he from?
He was some eastern county, mid-eastern county, and I don't even remember that. I'd have to go to the library and look it up. And I should do that. But we would discuss bills kind of by the hour. And I don't remember whether he stayed here. I'm the only one that stayed at the YMCA. I don't know where John stayed. He was a very serious, committed statesman.
And you've had no contact with him in recent years?
No, after this session, I mean, or something.
So you don't know if he was reelected or anything like that?
I think he was reelected, but I'm not sure about that either.
Mm-hmm.
He was a good person.
It might be interesting for me to contact him if he's, you know, if he was young, he might still be somebody who would like to
meet him. He may have been 2 or 3 years older than I. I'll look his name up if you'd like. I'll have to go to the library.
Okay.
You know, check back.
I might have some old copper books. I don't know if they go back that far.
Some old what?
Do you remember the copper books? Maybe they didn't have them when you were there, but the Anaconda Company used to publish a copper-colored book that had a picture of just the vital statistics on each legislator for each legislative session. And they'd give them out at the beginning of the session. So they'd be in alphabetical order. And if you were there, your picture would be in it, and, you know, your date of birth, and if you were a veteran or not, and, you know, whether you were a Lutheran or a Presbyterian or a Catholic, and, you know, wife and 3 children, serves on the thus and such committee, and the thus and such committee, first elected in 19, whatever it was, and so on.
I kind of vaguely remember that. But I can, you know, in the codes or the records of the laws that were passed.
Yeah.
What do they call it?
The Montana Code Annotated or the Revised Code of Montana?
No, it would be just the...
The Journal?
Journal.
Yeah.
His name would be in there.
Yeah, it would be. Sure, it would be.
I'll look it up. I have looked it up a couple of times, years past, but then I guy. So.
Now, Carl, there was someone else who was a legislator at that time that became a pretty eminent figure in state politics shortly after you left state politics, and that was J. Hugo Aronson.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember him at all?
Well, I think he was in the legislature when I was.
Yeah.
And I remember him as a big man, a friendly man, you know, just... I think he had an accent. I think he spoke English.
Yes, yeah.
He was. He seemed to be well liked. Yeah. But I didn't. I don't think we ever spoke face to face. That's all I know about him. And I know that he died out here at the Veterans Hall.
Yeah.
I do volunteer work out there. Yeah. So I think of it once in a while as I go down the corridors.
Let me mention a couple more names that. May have come after you, I'm not sure. Does the name Al Wilkinson ring a bell?
No.
Does the name Denny Shea ring a bell?
No.
Billy Ray?
No.
Boo McGilvera?
Yeah.
What do you remember about him?
Well, I think he was in the Senate when I was in the House.
That could be.
And
from Lake County?
Pardon me?
From Lake County?
Oh, is that where he was?
Well, that's where he served in the state Senate from. But he was also a lobbyist for many years. The names I just mentioned were prominent Montana Power and Anaconda Company lobbyists.
Oh,
I think Anaconda Company lobbyists, actually.
Okay. Mm. Maybe that's where I heard Boo McGilvera's name.
He represented, I think, Montana Power Company for a while, but he also served in the state Senate from Lake County, but I think it was prior to when you were there, but it might not have been. But he was a pretty prominent lobbyist in the...
Yeah, well, somehow I know the name.
You know, that's a kind of a memorable name. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was famous for the baking powder biscuits story.
Yeah.
And I came to the legislature. He was pretty elderly. He served on the State Historical Society Board. And he once told me the baking powder biscuits story. I'll tell you. If you're
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'm going to tell you right now, I guess. He came to Montana from Baraboo, Wisconsin. So that's how he got the nickname Boo. I don't know what his real name was. And when he was just a teenager, and he was interested in being a cowboy. So he got a job as a cowboy with no experience at a ranch up near Havre in the Little Rockies, somewhere up, I think, probably east of Havre. And he was involved in a roundup at a time of year when it was cold and snowy and that sort of thing. I don't know if it would have been early in the spring or late in the fall or whenever it was. But he was up in the mountains, inexperienced, 17, 18 years old, and he got lost. And he was frightened, and he was cold, and he was hungry, and he'd been up there for 2 or 3 days, and he came across this little dugout that obviously had been inhabited. And he went inside and struck a match and maybe lit a candle or something or other. Anyway, he got to kind of see inside, and there was a stove there, and he found a skillet, and he found some flour, and he found some baking powder in a can on the shelf, and he put all that stuff together, put some water in it, and got a fire going in the stove and made himself some sort of crude, crunchy, they didn't rise very well, he said, baking powder biscuits, but they were something to get in his stomach, you know, and it really tasted good to him. And he was finishing up with those when this man who lived in the dugout came into the dugout. And he was an Indian man. And he told Boo, relax, sit down, if everything's fine. Obviously you were hungry and needed something to eat and a place to find shelter. And so they struck up a conversation. And it turned out this old guy was from the Dakotas. And his family had been killed in the Wounded Knee Massacre. And he'd been a hermit in the Montana mountains for most of the time since then. He'd come there as a young man and just kind of subsisted up there in the mountains. And he told Boo, he said, you know, he said, it's been kind of a lonely life, but he said, and I came here a long time ago and I just kind of lived up here in this lonely and solitary life by myself. He said, when the Wounded Knee Massacre occurred, of course, it was in the winter and the ground was frozen, so they couldn't bury the dead, so they cremated him. And he said, in fact, he said, that's my dad's ashes in that Calumet baking soda can or baking powder can here on the shelf that Boo had just eaten in his baking powder biscuits.
Wow.
And he told that story to a lot of guys over the years. And when I was a young legislator, I had a friend named Bill Kirkpatrick who had been a lobbyist, and then he'd been away to New York for a while, and then he returned to Montana again. But he was interested in history, and he liked to talk to me, and I enjoyed him very much. And he said, well, gosh, he said, the guy you should meet is Boomer Gilbert. He was a lobbyist here for many years, and have him tell you the baking powder biscuit story. So I found him and sat down with him in the Senate cloakroom, and he knew immediately when I mentioned the baking powder biscuit story, and he told me the story I just told you.
Wow, that's a great story.
Well, anything else you can think of?
Oh, you know, you get ego involved in something like this, and you have to be careful.
Well, say what's on your mind.
No, no, I don't really. I was. My mind is still lingering on this business of the ethics and the dedication of a lot of good people. But I also remember who was having an affair. Like, there was one guy there. He was in a house. And his secretary from home was there, and they were staying together in Helena during the session. And I happened into a place to eat breakfast one morning, and there they were eating breakfast. And, oh, they were kind of shocked to have me. It was an out-of-the-way place.
Uh-huh.
So there was, you know, it was humanity. It mm-hmm. was humanity. And all elements of humanity and human behavior were there, but I still think that.
Do you remember a legislator named Frank Hazelbaker?
Yes. Remember the name Hazelbaker?
Well, he was, I think, in the House of Representatives sometime in the, well, he might not have been.
Ahead of me.
Yeah, I think he might have been, yeah.
Didn't he become?
He was a Speaker of the House, and he was a public service commissioner and that sort of thing, but I think you're right. I think he was there earlier in the 40s, and then he was there again later in the 60s.
Wasn't he a warden of the prison?
I don't think so, but I don't know for sure.
Okay.
Middleton was.
Oh, Middleton.
Yeah.
Incidentally, I don't know what your relationship with students will be at the university, but the first warden of the Montana State Prison is a fascinating figure.
Frank Conley?
Yes. Yeah. And I once thought of trying to do a biography of him, but it would require going to Helena for a couple of months just to do research, and probably in Missoula. But history needs to record that man's career.
Well, I'll tell you, have you got the biography of Joe Dixon?
Yes.
There are numerous references to Conley in that book.
And I've read those. Yeah. And I did write a short story on him that's been published, but it was mainly truthful. But the ending was fictional. But anyway, there's something. If a student was looking for a research project, I would surely encourage somebody who was interested in biography and politics and so on. He was an influential man in the Republican Party of his state.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I visited when I was running for governor, I visited the penitentiary in Deer Lodge and was given a tour, and the tour included taking me up to Conley Lodge.
Oh.
Because the prison ranch was Conley's ranch.
Yeah.
And the convicts worked on his ranch.
Yes.
And he had this little pond up in the mountains on the edge of his ranch, and this beautiful little lodge.
Yeah.
And the fellow who was conducting the tour said that Warden Conley entertained prominent politicians up there on a more or less regular basis. They could do a little fishing in his trout pond. They could have a good meal. They could drink some whiskey, have a very relaxed weekend in a beautiful place and that sort of thing. And so he wasn't just an ordinary rancher and prison warden. He was one of the most influential people in state politics.
He was. And he's the only prison warden that I know of who ended up well-to-do. Because he built the town of Deer Lodge with prison labor.
Yeah.
They put him in the streets and the water system, the sewer system. And so he was quite a person.
Yeah, he was quite a person. In fact, I understand that prison labor was important even in highway construction projects around the state. And he was,
yeah, they built part of the East Shore.
East Shore Flathead Lake was built by prison.
Lubang. They brought 75 prisoners and two guards camped out down there. Huh. It's amazing.
When was that?
Oh,
the 20s?
I presume it was the 20s. I'm kind of forgotten.
And he was, before we conclude our interview, you know, there's a person that I've long been interested in from here in this area that you might have known, or I'll bet your dad knew, John E. Erickson, who was governor in the 20s and early 30s.
Yeah, he lived a block from us in Kalispell.
Whereabouts did he live?
On First Avenue West.
I see.
And it'll be about the, I think he lived in the 600 block, maybe 500 block.
Yeah, Lois Himsel told me she remembered vaguely the Erickson family.
Yeah, they lived. Himsels in the same block. We did.
Well, the Woolwens, right? Lois's maiden was Woolwens?
Right.
Yeah. And you knew her.
Oh, yeah.
You grew up with her.
She had rubber tired roller skates.
Do you remember anything about Governor Erickson?
No. I think he was before my time.
Yeah, he was. He left office in 1932, and he was in the U.S. Senate briefly until 1934.
Oh.
And I think he may have retired in Helena, not in Kalispell, but he was a district judge in Kalispell prior to his election as governor, and he was governor for the 20s, most of the 20s, and into the 30s.
Yeah.
He defeated Dixon in 1924,
but
certainly your dad would have known.
Oh, yeah, he went. And I don't think he had a real strong record, did he?
Well, the historians haven't been real kind to him.
Yeah.
Dixon was a flamboyant independent.
Yeah.
And he got in trouble with the powers that be in the state for trying to tax the Anaconda Company on its I think it's gross proceeds or net proceeds or something or other. And anyway, he had determined a way to tax them where they really had to pay taxes. And they couldn't get out of it by some kind of bookkeeping sleight of hand as they had been doing before.
Uh-huh.
And his tax measure finally succeeded by initiative. He couldn't get it through the legislature. But then he was defeated by Erickson in the general election, and Erickson was generally regarded as the candidate that the Anaconda Company backed to defeat Erickson, or to defeat Dixon. And he remained not very memorable governor, but he was elected three times.
Oh, you mean Erickson.
Erickson,
yeah.
But he was a prominent citizen in Kalispell when your dad would have been a young businessman.
Yeah.
Well, one of my interviews this afternoon is going to be with Matt Himsel.
Oh, well, that should be good.
That should be a good one, I think. And he was the Republican County Chairman during the 1950s for most of that period of time. I've heard him mention Vic Morgan before, and you mentioned Vic Morgan earlier in the conversation.
Yeah, but they would have been friends, I think.
Well, he knew him, at least. I've heard him mention Vic Morgan.
Yeah.
I think I heard him mention one time that there was some kind of a thing down at the Daly Interlake. Maybe this might have been Jim Murphy, too, because I've heard Jim Murphy mention Vic Morgan as well. But that there were some Republican elders that were invited down to the Interlake by Morgan at night, and it was some kind of a hurried meeting, and they had to get something together, you know, for some big news story, and with Morgan it was usually kind of exciting and kind of conspiratorial.
Oh, yeah.
That sort of thing.
Yeah, that fits.
That fits, huh?
Uh-huh.
Well, look, I think we're about ready to conclude our interview. Anything you want to say to just kind of wrap it up?
Well, I don't think so. I just, I've really enjoyed our get-together, and I was surprised that you even thought of asking me to do this. And it's been fun, and I wish you well. I think you've been a great citizen.
Okay. That's enough. Well, great. Thanks, Carl. Thanks so much.
Now,